Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kohinski, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday the 21st of September. I'm actually going to start with the 21st this week, but not in the sense you'd think. I know it's a Sunday, but it's also the Feast of St. Matthew. I missed St. Matthew out last year because I was too busy with Cyprian and so on, and I don't want to wait until Monday the 21st of September 2026 to talk about Matthew, so I will focus on him now. You won't see Matthew in the liturgical parts of Universalis, obviously, because the Sunday takes over, but there's still a painting of him in the About Today page, and the spiritual reading page has a piece by the Venerable Bede about Christ's calling of Matthew. They are both worth a look. St. Matthew wrote the first Gospel. If you wanted to make a paradox out of it, you could say the Gospels are important because they are unimportant. What I mean is this. In themselves, they are not literary works for us to look at, but they are something we look through, the way we look through a window at the view outside. They point beyond themselves to Christ, the coming of Christ, the actions of Christ, and the salvation of mankind. For that matter, the evangelists too are important because they are unimportant. They do not say, "Look at me, I am an evangelist," or even, "Look at me, I am an apostle." They point beyond themselves, through the Gospels they have created, to Christ, the coming of Christ, the actions of Christ, and the salvation of mankind. When I say the Gospels they have created, it's a little risky. It makes me sound like one of those Bible scholars who, when you want them to comment on a passage from a gospel, the first thing they think is, "What made the evangelist invent this?" Pity those scholars, but do take care to pity them from a safe distance. What the evangelists did was report rather than create. But still, there is a certain amount that is creative even in the act of reporting. They had to explain to people in a way that people could understand, and they certainly had to select. When you are writing a biography of anyone, you have to choose what to put in and what to leave out, or the biography would end up as long as a human life. As St. John puts it at the end of his Gospel, there were many other things that Jesus did. If all were written down, the world itself would not hold all the books that would have to be written. Choosing what stories you need to tell the story, is a problem every writer faces. Why not just write a longer book? It's not that easy. In those days, when you wanted to write a book, you didn't go to the stationers the way we do now and get a packet of sheets of paper. You went to the shop and you asked for a book roll, and the shopkeeper gave you a book roll, a single roll of papyrus of a standard book length. If what you ended up writing was shorter, you'd be wasting expensive, unused papyrus. If what you wanted to write was longer, you couldn't, because it wouldn't fit. Of our Gospels, Matthew and John are one-roll books. Luke is a two-roll book, Luke Volume 1, The Life of Christ, and Luke Volume 2, The Acts of the Apostles. Mark is strange in that he's too short for a roll. But then Mark is strange, and in some ways he isn't quite a book. I said that the Gospels and the Evangelists are unimportant compared to the truths they are telling, but we do need to understand a little bit about the Gospels all the same. The picture I have in my head now is of looking out of the window at a view. It is the view you are interested in, the trees, the hills, the buildings, whatever it may be. But you are looking at it through the glass, and the glass still matters. The glass may be clean or dirty. The glass may be the good old-fashioned kind that was made by real people and shows it with a bit of a ripple in it, wonderful, beautiful stuff, or it may be a machine-made flat nothing. We don't need to study the glass, as if the view didn't matter, but we do need to have some sense of what kind of glass we are looking through so that we can properly understand what we are seeing through it. For instance, from the earliest times we've known that St. John's Gospel is different from the others. It is the final Gospel, just as St. John is the final Apostle. So it reflects, it summarizes, it tries to understand much more than it tries to narrate. As for the other three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, there's a little bit of a puzzle here because they all seem to be doing the same thing. Telling the story, the teaching, the miracles, the passion, the atonement. Why have three? Matthew's is definitely the senior gospel. In the very earliest years, his was the only gospel. All the other evangelists had some knowledge of Matthew when they wrote their own gospels. Even St. Paul, when he refers to a gospel theme as the wording of St. Matthew's gospel in his mind. Matthew's is the Jewish gospel. Christianity had to start somewhere. It started in the world of God's chosen people, the Jews. It started from who they were and took them to who they were to become. We know that, tragically, many of them did not follow that path, but there were many who did. Here's an image from natural history. You can think of the Jews becoming Christians as a kind of metamorphosis. Judaism was a tadpole, it needed to become a frog. Metamorphosis is a pretty alarming prospect for a tadpole. I have gills to breathe with, you want me to lose them. I have a tail to swim with, you want me to lose that. You want me to climb out onto dry land, where I don't belong, and run around on funny new things called legs, and to breathe air instead of water. I'd much rather stay how I am, thank you very much. St. Matthew's Gospel, then, is the Gospel to the tadpoles. It breathes reassurance from the outset, the reassurance that comes from continuity. That genealogy, which bores every reader in the first chapter of the Gospel according to Matthew, shows the continuity. We are deep in the world of the Old Testament. Most of the names are familiar Old Testament ones. So the message is not, tear up everything you ever knew and start again from the beginning. It is, here is the development and the final fulfilment of everything you already know and are. Far from becoming obsolete, you as a Jew can feel proud of your part in the salvation of the human race. Matthew's first task, when telling us that something new has happened, is to tell us that in a sense it is nothing new after all. It is an unfolding of a bud from the Old Testament. It was there all along, waiting to grow. Right through the Gospel there is connectedness, connectedness with the past, with tradition, with being a Jew. The Jews have all the mental categories they need to follow the story Matthew is telling them. Prophets, prophecies, miracles, persecution. They have read about them all in their Bible already. Matthew can mention the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Herodians without having to explain who they are. The Jews know them. Matthew can talk about the law versus the Pharisees' interpretation of it. He can talk about the temple tax. These were questions the Jews were all talking about. Matthew's Gospel is the Jewish Gospel. For a long time it was the Gospel, full stop. Everyone ended up knowing it. But there came a time, the Acts of the Apostles tells the story, when it became clear that although many of the Jews did grow lungs and legs and climb up out of the water and lose their tails and breathe air, fulfilling their destiny completely, many did not. And then came Paul. Paul, the Pharisee, who was converted directly by Christ, became Paul the Apostle to the Gentiles, the very people he had despised. Paul went from one city to another, encouraging the Christians he found, pulling them together, guiding the infant churches. He did that when he was there with them, and he did it when he had left them by letter, and his letters are now part of the New Testament readings we hear in church. But here is the thing about being a Gentile. On the one hand, the apostles, guided by the Holy Spirit, had decided that you did not have to become a Jew in order to become a Christian. Circumcision, the dietary laws, all that. Over and over again, Paul has to remind Gentile Christians of this when they have doubts or when someone unsettles them by telling them they are not proper Christians after all. But the one and only gospel in existence is still a Jewish gospel. You can't understand it until you have plunged deep into Jewish culture so that you can read it as if from a Jewish point of view. So in her teaching and in her documents, the church is contradicting herself. On the one hand, you don't need to be a Jew. but on the other hand, you have to understand what it is to be a Jew. It is complicated and a little pointless. For an example, look again for a moment at that genealogy at the beginning of Matthew. It mattered a lot to the Jews. It seems pointless to us. But to the Greek-speaking Gentiles, it was hideous. You will think me silly if I tell you that it's a matter of the names, but sometimes the silly things are the most important ones. Civilized, normal names in Greek end with an N like Xenophon, or an S like Achilles, or an R like Hector, or with a vowel like Athene. You can't read Greek for any length of time without feeling in your bones that that is how it should be. But the beginning of Matthew, which ought to be your gate to a new life of salvation and enlightenment, you find Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Abiud, Eliud, and the alienness hits you, and you think, salvation and enlightenment are all very well, but how alien am I going to need to become so that these names become normal to me? While Paul was going around preaching, none of this mattered so much, because the glow of the Spirit shone on everything. But Paul couldn't be everywhere at once. He was missing, presumed drowned, for a whole winter when he was shipwrecked on Malta on his way to Rome, and he might be executed at any time. And anyway, apostles don't live forever. Something had to be done. The Jews had their gospel, the Gentiles needed theirs. Luke was the one to do it. Luke had accompanied Paul on his travels, so he knew what kind of teaching worked best with the Gentiles, what they understood easily, what needed to be explained to them. Luke was a doctor, educated, fluent in Greek, so with Paul at his side, Luke sat down and wrote his two-volume book about Jesus and the church. This was a book that really worked like a book. It didn't start with a genealogy that didn't make sense unless you were a Jew, and it didn't assume that you had the whole of Jewish culture and history soaked into your bones. It was a simple, well-shaped narrative that anyone who read Greek, which meant everyone who read books, could pick up and read and get something out of. Luke said it in his introduction, "I am going to tell everything in a proper sequence, in an organized way." This was biography the way a proper biographer would write it. Issues of purely Jewish interest were left out. When something Jewish needed explaining, who the Sadducees were or the importance the Jews gave to washing, it was explained quickly and briefly on the spot. Anybody could read this gospel and everybody could learn from it. At last we had two gospels for the two sides of Christianity. For the Jews, who looked out of the world through a Jewish window and had Judaism in their bones, there was the original gospel, the Gospel of Matthew. For the Gentiles, who needed to learn to become Christians without having to become imitation Jews first, there was the gospel written by Paul's companion, the Gospel according to Luke. This was good, except for one thing. When there are two, there is trouble. However much we say, here are two windows through which you can see the truth, people are going to ask, which window is best? If, for instance, Luke leaves out the feeding of the 4,000 because he hasn't got room for it, some people will say, Luke's gospel is incomplete, while others will say, Luke doesn't include the story because it didn't happen. People, even if they are Christians, love being right, especially if it puts someone else in the wrong. Look at the factions the Corinthians had, which Paul complains about so much. I am for Paul, I am for Apollos, and so on. Something had to be done, and done quickly, while the apostles were still around to sort out the mess. Paul was in Rome. Peter either came to Rome or was already there, and with him was his follower Mark. Peter did not settle the question by writing a definitive gospel of his own. If he had, it wouldn't have settled anything. 2 + 1 does not equal 1, it equals 3. We would simply have had 3 gospel factions instead of 2. I am for Matthew, I am for Luke, I am for Peter. Looking back in history, we can see that Peter never sorted anything out by doing. He sorted it out by being. When there was all that fuss decades before about dietary laws, about whether Gentile converts had to avoid seafood and pork, everyone knew it would be all right when Peter came, but not because Peter would make some sort of judicial decision. Only that once Peter was there, the rock, the massive foundation, suddenly all the questions that had seemed so important and so insoluble would become simple and straightforward and solve themselves. Now, in Rome, it happened again. The picture is this. The Gospels were read while Peter was there. Actually, the Greek in the Gospel is so much somebody's second language that quite possibly Peter read it himself. The parts of the Gospels of Matthew and Luke which were read were mostly those where Peter had been present so he could be authoritative about what happened. If anyone had got anything wrong in the Gospel, Peter could correct it. If there were little details that Peter could add to a story, adding a bit of life to it, having been on the spot, Peter would be able to add them. As for which Gospel to take, the principle was this. Painstaking scholars have worked it out. First, one Gospel would be read, either Matthew's or Luke's, and at some point either a story came that wasn't all that important and could be skipped, or the other Gospel, either Luke's or Matthew's, had a story of its own that needed putting in just there. So then the reader would switch from one scroll to the other and carry on with the new Gospel, until a point came where he needed to switch back again. It sounds complicated, but it isn't really. It's a bit like the stitching of a seam when first one thread and then the other thread is on top. Together the threads make a strong seam. That is what the audience saw and heard at those meetings when Peter was present, the sewing of a firm seam, uniting the two Gospels together so that the forces of history and politics could never tear them apart. Of course, notes would be taken. Shorthand writing was a recognised skill in Rome. Then, in due course, transcripts could be made of what had been read and what had been said. Transcripts are more spontaneous and colloquial than when someone deliberately sits down and writes a book, and indeed the language of Mark is exactly that, spontaneous, colloquial, and not always very correct. Peter didn't say to Mark, transcribe and publish, but he didn't say don't, either. He wasn't interested either way. It wasn't his job to be interested. A rock is a foundation, after all. A rock is not a builder. St. Mark's Gospel was published after Peter's death, because once people didn't have Peter anymore, they wanted a way of keeping in touch with him, and this was it. This is why St. Mark's Gospel is so different from the others. It is not written, it is spoken. It is lively and spontaneous for that reason. Even the earliest historians saw the difference from the other Gospels. They talked about Matthew as the author of his Gospel, Luke as the author of his Gospel, but Mark was only described as reporting what we call the Gospel according to Mark. Because, first of all, the speaker was actually Peter, not Mark, and second, Peter himself wasn't composing yet another Gospel, he was just stitching two Gospels together so that they could never be separated. The story I have told is what every sensible person has believed from the time church history began to be written, through the 4th century historian Eusebius, through St. Augustine of Hippo, who thought and wrote thoroughly about almost everything, very nearly up to the present day. Nearly but not quite. If Eusebius were a teacher at a seminary now and said what he said in his books, he would be sacked. If Augustine were a seminarian now and wrote in an exam today what he said back then in his books, then tomorrow he would be out on his ear and working somewhere as a barrister. At least this is what a seminarian told me a little while ago. Perhaps things have moved on. All this is because in the 19th century a mad fashion came in for believing that just as Darwin made us all be descended from a simple primeval blob, so the rule must be that St. Mark's Gospel, because it was the simplest, must have been the first. I suppose, in the same sense, you should say that since your child's school physics book is simpler than Newton's theory of gravitation, your child's book is older than Newton. Such nonsense breeds nonsense. The people in charge teach that there is an invisible gospel called Q, which is the source of all the bits of Matthew and Luke that aren't in Mark, and that there is an invisible first-century religious community that kept Q secret until it was time to let it loose on the world. And for that matter, that we can't know anything at all about what Jesus was really like, because all the Gospels we have are so long after his life and ministry that anything they say about him must just be myth. He was really a revolutionary socialist, or he was really a simple rabbi who never said he was God. Choose what you like. There's no evidence, so anyone can invent anything he wants. It keeps people in jobs. It lets them write journal articles and attack each other at conferences and generally have a good time. For those that like that kind of thing, that is the kind of thing they like. As for you and me, let's try a radical spiritual exercise. If you're afraid, try it in secret. Read the Gospel according to Matthew as if it was written by St. Matthew the Apostle. Read the Gospel according to Luke as if it was written by Luke, the companion of Paul, and the Gospel according to Mark as if it was written by Mark, the disciple of Peter. And of course, and above all, read the Gospel according to John as if it was written by the beloved disciple St. John. Which I suppose can take us to actually reading St. Luke's Gospel instead of arguing about it. So let's do that. This Sunday's Gospel talks about money. Money, as we know, is a good servant but a bad master. Money also ties in with what someone wrote to me a few weeks ago to ask. Can investment bankers be saved? He said. Well, of course, I'm not going to tell you. I know nothing about banking, or less than nothing. I have never understood money. But I will tell you that if the money you are playing around with as a banker is made of people, pay attention to the people, because the people are the only thing that matters. When you are building a bridge and arranging 30-year finance to make the bridge buildable, that's one thing. If you are bundling together consumer debt and selling it at a discount, and you forget that your bundle is made of people sitting in the cold and dark, subsisting on pasta boiled in the water some broccoli was once cooked in, all because they were offered loans and took them and can't pay, then that is another thing altogether. If I were a priest and a confessor, here is the penance I would set you for bundling up the hopes and dreams and mistakes and distress of 1,000 families and buying and selling them as if they were so many potatoes. Ignore 999 out of those 1,000. Pick one family and become part of that family. Hold their hands. In every financial decision they make, make sure it is the right one for them. Prevent their mistakes. Dig them out of their troubles using everything you have except money, because when you are with them, you are like them. That financial world you have helped to create, see it through their eyes, and then perhaps when you return to your office high above them, you will have learnt something. See the financial world through their eyes week after week, and one day you will see through their eyes the brightness of the kingdom of heaven. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.